This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Kiss your old climate goodbye. That's the word from scientists and measuring agencies on all fronts. John Vidal of The Guardian was among the first to report that measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at Hawaii's Mauna Loa Observatory hit an all-time new high in February 2013 at 396.8 parts per million. We are pumping out greenhouse gases at ever faster rates. The increase in 2012 was 2.67 parts per million. That is the second highest on record. Oh, did you hear about Justin Bieber? Is he okay in London? Well, what is the Pope going to do? Oh, excuse me while I interrupt with the actual news. The highest was in 1998 at 2.93 parts per million, when the Indonesian peat fires made that developing country the third largest emitter in the world. But now we're setting a new record just from fossil fuel emissions. Scientists used to say we were increasing at 2 parts per million annually. Models were based on that. Now it's heading towards 3. And increasing incrementally. The head of the gas measurement program at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Pieter Tans, said the increase is from fossil fuel burning, and our chances of staying below 2 degrees C, that safe level supposedly, are, quote, fading away. Other researchers from Oregon State University published in the journal Science, quote, during the last 5,000 years, the Earth on average cooled about 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit, until the last 100 years, when it warmed about 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit, end quote. Earth is hotter now than it has been for the past 11,000 years. So it's on. Should we just cry about it? Probably. But in this program, I'll bring you two voices who claim we could still save a livable Earth. They won't give up on the outside chance humanity could turn back towards survival. Is the fossil fuel lobby too powerful? Start your own lobby. Mark Reynolds tells us how. Then we'll talk about the unspeakable. Did you know the IPCC admits there are two main drivers behind climate change, but they only look at one? You want to talk about solar power and wind power and carbon capture and storage and nuclear energy, tech, 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 but our guest, Philip Cafaro, editor of the new book, Life on the Brink, he's ready to face the nasty issues politicians and environmentalists agree should never be mentioned. Hot radio for unstable times. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. All the big corporations have lobbyists in Washington. Every member of Congress has a posse of lobbyists who visit, they make donations, or some take them out on golf vacations in exotic places. And that's not just in America, but in pretty well every country. When it comes to climate, who lobbies for us? Who will speak for our descendants? Our guest is Mark Reynolds. He's the executive director of the nonprofit group called the Citizens Climate Lobby. Mark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much.
Before we get to what you do, I wonder, can we agree that the worst impacts of climate disruption are yet to come, that our kids and our grandchildren will inherit this big change, most likely after you and I have passed on?
Yeah, no question. I mean, Hurricane Sandy is just indicative of that. I mean, when you have the ocean on the East Coast that's somewhere between 8 inches and 12 inches higher than it used to be, so the storm surge starts with a higher bottom, and that's only going to exacerbate, certainly the future looks worse than the present right now.
When you speak to groups around the country, as I know you do, how do you get them to picture the future they want to save? For example, tell us about Finding Our Plum.
One of the things that we ask the people in our organizations to do, so Citizens Climate Lobby always says, let's work for the hard thing, not just the easy answer. And by that I mean it's easy to know who you disagree with, who's wrong, who you think's stupid. There's a whole cottage industry in the cable television shows and radio shows where all they do is spend time essentially trying to do character assassination. And that's easy and it's lazy and anybody can do it. So part of what we do is always ask people to speak of what they're in favor of. And part of the process in that is we actually believe that we can find common ground with anybody because everybody has things about the planet that they find precious. And, for example, the specific question you were asking about is we do an exercise early in our workshops where we ask people to identify what is something that is important to them that could be jeopardized by climate change that they want to make sure is around for future generations. And the example I always cite is, you know, when I was a little kid, I used to love to go around the neighborhood during summer and eat fresh fruit off of my neighbor's trees. Now, you know, one thing is fruit you pick from a tree is obviously way different tasting than what you get in the store. But if you're a little kid and you're jumping over a fence and you're stealing it, it makes it taste even better. So I have, in fact, been planting fruit trees in my backyard for 30 years because I wanted my, I have three children in their 20s, my grandkids to have that experience of what it's like to pick something fresh off of a tree. And I did pick a plum tree, which was my favorite fruit tree during the summer. And it used to make great fruit, and 4 years ago it stopped making fruit. So I went to my local nursery and asked them why, and they said it's because the winters in San Diego don't get cold enough anymore, and most fruit trees require a certain number of hours under 45 degrees, depending upon the fruit tree, to fruit. So in the question of how do you have people find their plum, our starting point anytime we meet with a member of Congress or Parliament in Canada is that there are common areas that we have. And that if it's nothing more that we can find something specific that they love about the planet that they want to preserve. And I'll give you a simple example. Not the current Senator Warner of, the one who just left of Virginia, but the one before, never voted the way we thought he would on the environment. And then he introduced a climate bill that looked pretty good to us. And we wondered why. And when we dug into it, we found that he loved fly fishing. And the area in which people can fly fish is diminishing because trout are so sensitive to temperature. So, you know, the easy way out on this is to look for places where we disagree with people and dismiss them because they've disagreed with us. What we try and start from is there are things for everybody about the planet that they love that have the potential of being jeopardized by climate change. And if we start there, we think we can build from there rather than starting from where we disagree with them.
So you're even going to talk to people who deny climate change or say it's a hoax, like the Tea Party people?
We've been into Senator Inhofe's office three times. We've been to Eric Cantor's office four times. So I think that most of the people who work at climate change demonize Senator Inhofe, and they probably should, because he said so many things that are irresponsible, and he has this list of, quote, scientists on his website who say that climate change is a hoax. We just think if we can bring him to the table, we have a better chance of success than by merely demonizing him. I don't think he'll ever walk away from his views on science, but I think he will agree with us that there's a lot of potential wind and solar power in the state of Oklahoma and that we should build on that. Now, that being said, I get a debrief meeting notes on every meetings with members of Congress, and certainly the ones with Senator Inhofe were very interesting. The meeting was scheduled for 20 minutes. It lasted for an hour, which is always one of our indications of that maybe we're doing our work correctly is because they're asking us to stay longer. The young aide, which, you know, a lot of congressional aides are in their 20s, walking out with five women who are faculty at the University of Oklahoma, are all middle-aged, and he said to them, you know, Senator Inhofe isn't a bad person. People think he's a bad person. People think he eats children. He does not, in fact, eat children. It's the only debrief meeting notes I ever got that said the senator does not eat children. I've been waiting for a meeting with him to ask the famous, can you confirm or deny this report? But there's one other piece that was really interesting with Inhofe. Part of our practice when we meet with politicians is to always ask them who they work with on the other side of the aisle. Now, if you ask the general question is, how is it working with Tea Partiers, progressive Democrats, liberals, Republicans, whatever, you get them in campaign mode and they start to throw bombs. When you ask the specific question of, are there people on the other side of the aisle that you like working with, you get interesting answers. So Inhofe's office consistently answers that question with Barbara Boxer. So you have Boxer, who's probably at the extreme left end of politics, Inhofe, who's at the extreme end of right, but in terms of individuals, they like working with each other. So, you know, yes, we will meet with anybody, and we certainly think that if we can include them in the discussion, rather than be dismissive, it gives us a better chance of success.
Well, let's back up a little bit in time then. Tell us who founded the Citizens Climate Lobby, and also about the successful model you hope to recreate for getting political action on climate change.
Great. Okay, so Marshall Saunders is a 73-year-old retired businessman from San Diego, California. He spent 20 years before he started Citizens Climate Lobby setting up microcredit loans in third world countries. So microcredit happens when you go to the poorest of the poor people in the world. You lend them very small amounts of money, you know, $10, $20, $30. They start a business in their village that could be something as simple as a goat and selling milk or a couple of chickens and selling eggs. it ends up that they then, that's enough of a difference to lift their own family up out of poverty, and 98% of microcredit loans are repaid, which then goes to set up the next set of loans in the village. So Marshall's personally initiated over 1 million microcredit loans. I think a lot of people have heard of Muhammad Yunus, the gentleman who invented microcredit in the Grameen Bank. Marshall's only one of 6 people that have won the Grameen Humanitarian Award, and the other recipients are people like former Queen Sophia of Spain. So he's going along trying to make as much impact on worldwide poverty as he can, and saw Vice President Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. He and I had the exact opposite reaction. I thought I was off the hook because at the end of the movie, Vice President Gore says, you don't have to deal with the whole problem. Just change your light bulbs, do your little bit, and that will be enough. I thought that was fantastic. I changed my light bulbs, put my head back under the pillow, and hoped that the rich, smart, connected people would figure out how to deal with it. Marshall actually went to the movie 4 times in 10 days because what he couldn't get out of his head was here were millions of people in Bangladesh who had lifted themselves up out of poverty with microcredit, and because Bangladesh is one of the most low-lying countries in the world, any rise in sea level would jeopardize their ability to live or grow crops. So he thought, wow, here's 20 years of remarkable work we've done with people where they've lifted themselves up out of poverty that could potentially be completely undermined by climate change. So he asked Vice President Gore to train him. He was one of the first Climate Reality Project presenters. He started doing that fanatically, but started to worry early on if what he was doing was going to work, because he made his 3rd presentation one night, and the people were enthusiastic about reducing their carbon footprint. They thought, you know, I could drive a smaller car. I could buy local. I could change my light bulbs. And then he read the paper the next morning, and the paper said Congress had just given an $18 billion tax break to the oil companies. And he said the thought that went across his head right then as he read the paper was, wow, I got 18 light bulbs changed. Congress just gave an $18 billion tax break. So what he realized at that moment is the people's behavior he really needed to focus on was not just individuals, but Congress. Now, if I had that realization, I throw in the towel and I say, I can't work with Congress. That's too hard. There's too much money. As you mentioned, there's so many lobbyists. There's 2,300 paid lobbyists on the issue of energy and climate in D.C. But he had been working in partnership with an organization called Results. And Results isn't like us, an all-volunteer organization, but they lobby exclusively on reducing poverty worldwide. And what Results proved is if you organize people by congressional district, so it was easy to get into their member of Congress, if you gave them a good support structure, if you gave them good messaging, if you trained them, you could actually get Congress to do things that nobody could predict. So, for instance, I'll give you an example of what something nobody could predict. 30 years ago, Results started asking the United States government to appropriate money to alleviate worldwide poverty. You know, some things like childhood immunizations, or oftentimes currently it's the fund for AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And the U.S. used to give $25 million a year. Well, the annual appropriation for quite some time now has been $500 million a year. And when you ask members of Congress, how has that money been protected, they tell you it's because the Results volunteers are so effective. So what Marshall did was, he said, if I can just find an environmental group that is building the grassroots support back in the district so that when the members vote, there is support back home, we can get an effective climate bill passed. And he talked to a lot of great organizations doing really, really good work, but nobody who was building the actual grassroots support. So what we did was, 5 years ago, in the absence of an organization doing that, we simply took a model that had already proven to be effective with Congress and replicated it on the climate side. Now, we still are very supportive of our micro-lending projects in Mexico, but all of our efforts are towards getting the U.S. to pass an effective climate bill.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Mark Reynolds, the executive director of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Well, Mark, let's get down to work. How does the climate lobby operate?
Yeah, it's a pretty simple structure. What we do is we go in and we train groups we come to their community and do a 3-hour training on how you generate grassroots support. And then there's a very simple support structure that's not really time intensive, but it's, you might say, commitment intensive. What happens is the first Saturday of each month, we have a conference call where our 82 chapters, mostly in the U.S., some in Canada, call in, and we do 3 things. One is we educate ourselves. so that, you know, we've had the best scientists in the world. Dr. James Hansen's been on. Richard Somerville, the lead author for IPCC 2007, has been on. Actually, my favorite climate scientist was Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. She's a Canadian-trained climate scientist who teaches at Texas Tech, who by faith is evangelical. Her husband's an evangelical minister. He takes a literal translation of the Bible and thinks that the planet is 6,000 years old. She's a climate scientist. She said on this issue, they've just agreed to disagree. So we've had great scientists. We've had a lot of economists on. Economists always have a very simple message. They say, if you want less of something and you want it quickly, the fastest way to do so is to make it more expensive. And the example they always point to is cigarette smoking, where over half the U.S. used to smoke, now less than 20% do. And the economists insist that pricing was the single biggest factor in reducing smoking. There's an interesting club that a lot of economists belong to. There's an English economist with a French-sounding name named André Pigou. Last name spelled P-I-G-O-U, and there's something called the Pigouvian Club. What those economists believe is that sometimes the market fails and that products that we buy are underpriced. And they say sometimes the market fails because the costs to society are not included in the direct price of the product. And there's many economists who believe that coal and oil represent the biggest failure in the history of the free market. Because when you and I go buy gas at the pump, we do not include how much of our military budget that's designed to protect our oil interests around the world. Or anytime when we heat and cool our home, anytime fossil fuels are burned, coal, oil, natural gas, there are health-related impacts, and over 25,000 Americans die every year, and many more are hospitalized. So we don't pay that directly when we drive our car or heat or cool our home, but we pay higher insurance premiums. We pay more for Medicare and Medicaid to cover the health costs. So there's a lot of indirect costs that go into climate change, and that's, you know, depending upon who calculates it, then you begin to calculate things like the $60 billion at least for Hurricane Sandy, the drought in the Midwest last year, that Minnesota's had the 100-year flood three of the last 5 years. So we've a lot of economists, and they also all essentially say you've got to correct the market failure. Many people worry that renewable energy isn't on a cost-comparable basis with fossil fuels. It would be if we incorporated the externalities, but because we don't, fossil fuels cost way less than they should, and what we want to do is correct that market failure so that very quickly renewable energy is less expensive than fossil fuels. We've had some really interesting other scientists. There's a gentleman named Rob Willer who teaches at Berkeley who wrote a paper called Apocalypse Soon, Dire Messaging is Counterproductive. And what his paper essentially showed is that if all you do is give people the problems that have to do with climate change, that every time we measure the glaciers, they're disappearing more quickly, or that the problems in the ocean are way bigger than just whether the polar bear loses habitat, what happens is it just doesn't match up with people's basic view of reality, so they're not so sure that you know what you're talking about and probably are not inclined to get into action. On the other hand, if you give people the scope of the problem and you add, and here's how we can solve it, those same people who are not sure you knew what you were talking about are certain that you understand this better than anybody they've ever spoken to. That was pretty much a game changer for Citizens Climate Lobby because we realized that we needed to focus on solutions because that's what really got people into action. I'll just give you one more speaker's example. There's a gentleman named Mark Jacobson who teaches at Stanford who collaborated with Mark DeLucci from Cal Davis who've been studying 9,000 meteorological sites around the world. What they actually did was create a map to show how we could, because where it's viable to get energy from wind, solar, and geothermal, how we could transition the whole world's energy system to renewable energy in 20 years and how it wouldn't cost any more than existing energy costs and that would be with increased population between now and 20 years and increased energy demand. I think that's an important piece. So that's the first half of the call is we educate ourselves. Well, then we do two other things on the call, and that's what translates into what happens every month. We practice speaking. So we design short what we call laser talks, and there's a lot of components that go to climate change. So it's not just the science. There's economics. There's jobs. There's how do you deal with other countries if we price carbon and they don't. There's how do you contrast different ways of dealing with climate change. You know, there's a carbon tax, there's cap and trade, and there's EPA regulation. So how do you compare those and know what advantages one has of the other? So there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle, and every month we design short talks so that if our volunteers are meeting with a member member of Congress, if they're speaking with the media, or if they're doing a talk in general, every month they feel like they have additional fluency. And then the last thing we do is we ask people to get into action. We don't ask people to do anything random. We know that probably the most important thing they can do is get face-to-face time with their member of Congress and their staff. So we're always looking for opportunities when they're in the district, and once a year we go to Washington, D.C. to meet with as many members of the House and Senate as we can. Last year we scheduled, practiced, held, and debriefed 302 meetings. This year we plan to see the entire House and Senate. We also focus very much on getting published in North American papers. You know, sure, we use the modern things. I mean, we tweet, we Facebook. But I know, for instance, I live in San Diego. If I get my letter or an op-ed published in that paper, I have a message that's getting out to a million people. I also know that the congressional delegation reads the editorial page religiously, so anytime I'm getting a message there, I'm getting it to the audience I really need to get it to. So, for instance, in 2011, the volunteers published 182 letters to the editor saying we need to put an effective price on carbon. Last year, they published 535, and in January of this year, they published 108. So they're doing a lot to create grassroots support back in the community. We start from a fundamental place that, in general, politicians don't create political will. They respond to it. So that if we can do that through a combination of sitting down with them and telling them how they can solve this, reaching out to our newspapers, and then speaking out to community groups, particularly people that are not part of a big green coalition. So it's so important when military leaders or faith-based leaders or leaders in industry come speak up, because it's different if someone's minister speaks with them than somebody of Greenpeace does. So our activities are very much about every single month being in action, doing things back home, so that when members have a chance to make the vote, they know there's support for them back in the district.
Well, let's talk about what you are proposing. Can you give us just kind of a nutshell roundup of the solution proposed by the famous climate scientist James Hansen?
Right. So if you see James Hansen walking in with a proposed solution, that's something we wrote. And here's what it says. It essentially takes the advice that the economists say, which is that if you want less of something, make expensive more quickly. So what we do is put a straightforward fee, tax, if you want to call it, on carbon-based emissions wherever they come into the economy. So all the way what they say upstream, so at the oil well, at the coal mine, at the natural gas well. We've also talked to top legal experts at the World Trade Organization who say if the U.S. imposes a fee and other countries do not, that you can put a border tariff in place to protect American manufacturers if other countries do not have to incorporate a carbon fee in their goods. So what we would suggest is to start at $15 a ton of CO2 emitted. So what would that mean? Well, if we added a fee of $15 a ton of CO2 emitted, that would raise about 13 cents a gallon to the price of gasoline. So if we increase the cost of anything that generates CO2 by being burned into the economy, people's costs are going to go up. So the second part of our proposal is that you take every single dollar and you send it back to households as a dividend. There's at least three reasons that we would like all the money to go back. You know, a lot of people say, well, there's so many good things you could do with the money. You could reduce the deficit, you could fund renewable energy, you could do mass transit, you could do research, and all those would be worthy uses of the money. The reason we would like all the money to go back is, first, because energy costs are going to go up if we increase the price of fossil fuels, we want to make sure that impact is mitigated with the general public. So if you send all the money back, two-thirds of households will come out equal or better with their dividend check. And so we want to make sure that people have a modest carbon footprint. A, you know, if you got a couple of cars in a house, you're going to be okay. You are not going to see a net increase in cost because your dividend's going to cover it. We also think that drives behavior for people to say, well, if I'm getting a, quote, clean or green check and I reduce my carbon footprint, maybe I could ride my bike to work one day a week. Maybe I could keep the thermostat down a little bit and put a sweatshirt on in the evening. That actually allows it to stretch. But the second reason is there are still so many Republicans who are beholden to Grover Norquist's tax pledges, which essentially says they will not vote for any new tax that really essentially grows government. If we send all the money back, they can still honor their pledge and do the right thing. And then the third is this. We say we start at $15 a ton and raise that price $10 a ton for 10 years, which guarantees that in a minimum 10 years, renewable energy is more cost competitive than fossil fuels. We think that sends what they call an effective price signal. And for banks, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, they can see that it is obvious the new wave of our energy future is in renewable energy, and that will cause an enormous amount of innovation that we think the market will be a more efficient driver of innovation than the government can be. So, for instance, if we give the government the money to the government and say, okay, you pick who you're going to fund and who you're not going to fund, you know, some things will work and some won't. You know, that's like what we found so far, is some things work out and some things end up like Solyndra. And actually, the track record is usually better than not. But in the market's case, you're not picking winners and losers. You're letting everybody get in the game. It's kind of like a horse race and letting all the horses run. So we think, one, to protect the more poor middle class, essentially. Two, to make sure that people could vote the right way and still honor their Grover Norquist pledge. And three, to send the right market signal that we should give all the money back. And then maybe there's a fourth reason that might be as important as any. And that is, some economists would actually prefer that rather than sending a dividend like we and Dr. Hansen prefer, that they do some type of tax swap in the economy. And that might end up being what we get. But we think the dividend is more important because when the price starts at $15 a ton, people aren't going to feel it much and it won't, the dividend won't seem much. But when we raise it over time, it will become significant, and we think to maintain support in the public, people need to see a check coming back to them so they can see why they're continuing to support fossil fuels, energy costs continuing to go up.
So you'll bribe us with our own money in order to do the right thing, and I kind of like that.
I like the way you said that. Yes, we will bribe you to get you to do the right thing.
Well, we're starting to run out of time. I'm wondering, how do people get in touch with you, and is there another message that you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah, so certainly they could go to citizensclimatelobby.org, citizensclimatelobby.org. The direct number that they could reach us is area code 619-437-7142, 619-437-7142. I think maybe the most important thing that I could leave you with is that I think there's a lot of evidence that if people take on engaging with their government, they can actually make something happen. I think it's easier to kind of stay removed and, you know, if you can say something a little bit snarkier than your friend, you seemed informed, but it's not the same thing as doing something. We started writing significantly, you know, a lot of letters starting 4 years ago saying that this fee and dividend approach that we and Dr. Hansen advocate was the right way to go. And everybody said, that's impossible, you'll never get it done, cap and trade went down in flames, nobody will ever talk about this. But now you have Senator Sanders and Senator Boxer proposing a fee and dividend proposal. In November, you have the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., hosting a conference called The Economics of a Carbon Tax. So I think that if people will get in the game and engage themselves, rather than talk about how horrible it is that nothing has happened, they'll see a couple of things will happen. One is they can actually make things happen. And the other, and possibly just as importantly, is it does a lot of damage to people's basic cynical view. I don't know, cynical or not, but most people view that their life doesn't matter, they can't contribute, they can't make something happen, and I think we're providing a lot of evidence that if people will jump in and make something happen rather than talk about not making something happen, that their lives actually do matter on this issue.
You have been listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm in favor of trying anything and everything we can do to stop breaking the climate that nurtures us. Please consider mounting a Citizens Climate Lobby wherever you live. I think it can work in any country. Get ideas from www.citizensclimatelobby.org. Our guest has been CCL Executive Director Mark Reynolds. Mark, thank you for sharing with us, and thank you for keeping on trying.
Thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. The melting Arctic, that's far enough away. Electric cars or solar cities, that's far enough away too. But talk about fewer babies, those cute, lovable babies, or stopping immigration, or maybe state control of family size, and those are bombs that stimulate a kind of self-censorship even Greens go along with. Start talking about population control, and even the best listeners may start reaching to change that radio dial. And when I add that our guest, Philip Cafaro, specializes in ethics, that may not help. Ethics is hardly the hot buzzword of the day on TV or social media. So, Philip, we have about 30 seconds to convince our great Radio EcoShock listeners they need to hear this conversation. Why drag up population, immigration, and birth control just when we're finally getting the public on board with the reality of climate change?
Well, Alex, I think the fundamental reason is because people care about nature. They want to preserve the environment. They want to keep other species with us on the planet. And they want their children and grandchildren to live in a flourishing natural world. And you can't do that if you're not willing to look at population issues.
Well, I think personally there's a deep and embedded form of self-censorship at work here. I didn't necessarily look forward to doing this program. The whole issue makes me uncomfortable and maybe unpopular. But that's the point, isn't it? I mean, stopping climate catastrophe is not all happy thoughts and popularity. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. You know, it's great when we can find win-win solutions, and we need to look for those. But at the same time, as with anything in life, you have to confront the reality if you're going to move forward.
I think I should tell you, listeners, Philip Cafaro teaches philosophy at Fort Collins at Colorado State University. He's the co-editor of a new collection of essays called Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. The contributors are real green leaders, some of them already guests on Radio EcoShock, like Albert Bartlett, Lester Brown, and Paul Ehrlich. He does the introduction. And we hear from academics, but also from activists, too, like Dave Foreman of Earth First and Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society. So, Philip Cafaro, please give us a short introduction to this book, and then we'll try to defuse some of those bombs before they blow.
Well, Life on the Brink deals with the environmental impacts of overpopulation, and we deliberately went out and looked for contributors from a wide range of places, but we wanted to find people who, in general, had a biocentric outlook. So in other words, people who are sort of committed to the idea that human beings should share habitat and resources with other species. Quite often when people talk about population issues, it's all in terms of human carrying capacity. How many people can the Earth support, or can this particular region support? And that's an important question. But we also think it's important to ask, what would the optimum population be? And what should our population be if we want to keep bears and wolves and other species on the landscape with us? So our contributors explore those kinds of questions. They look at different ecosystems from the southeast to the Pacific Northwest. They look at wildlife issues, sprawl issues, water issues, and always with this question, how can we address population so that we can preserve the environment?
All right, well, why don't we dive into the contentious issue of immigration? In the United States, new polls show millions of Latinos are concerned about climate change. Now you seem to be saying we should stop immigration. It's a hot issue not just in the U.S., but in Australia and Canada, the U.K., most developed countries in Europe. Why, oh why, would environmentalists get involved in immigration debates?
Well, Alex, as I think you know, most environmentalists have run as quickly in the other direction as possible from that. So it's only a small minority of us who think that we do have to look at it. But the reason, especially in countries like the United States and Canada, to look at immigration is because in the United States, at least, we've managed to stabilize our population in terms of the fertility rates of the people living here. So if we did not have immigration, or if immigration was a lot lower than it is today, we'd essentially be looking at stabilizing our population at a few tens of millions of people more than it is today. So maybe at 330, 340 million people. At our current level of immigration, which is about 1.25 million annually, we're instead going to nearly double our population. So at our current level of immigration, we're looking at about 570 million people in the United States by 2100. Now, I would submit to your environmentally concerned listeners out there that it's going to be hard enough to create a sustainable United States or Canada with our current populations. If we double our populations, it's going to be just about impossible.
Well, plus, if we take people from an area, say, in Central America where they're using very little carbon, we bring them up to the States. They want that decent standard of American living. We get cars, maybe several cars per family. What happens then?
Yeah, it's really true. It turns out when you look at ecological footprints for the average American versus the average person from our main immigrant sender countries, Americans use about 3.5 times the resources, emit about 3.5 times the carbon, et cetera, as people in our main sender countries, Mexico, the Philippines, China, et cetera. So when you move people to the United States, not only are you increasing their resource use, but you're most likely increasing the resource use of their descendants down the line.
Well, let's talk about the scientists. What is the position of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, on population and climate change?
Well, that's a very interesting question. If you go to the IPCC's 2007 report, they're just unequivocal that population growth is one of the main drivers, one of the two main drivers of increased greenhouse gas emissions, which in turn are driving climate change. So the IPCC says, basically, the reason we've had increased emissions over the past 3 and 4 decades is that population has grown and per capita wealth has grown. Economic activity per person has grown. You take those two things together, and they've really swamped the good increases we've had in efficiency, in energy efficiency, and that's why we're generating more carbon. On the other hand, it's interesting, once you look at the proposals in the IPCC report to actually deal with climate change, they say almost nothing about reining in population growth. So it's kind of an interesting dichotomy there.
Right. We're going to bury the carbon. We're going to stop using as much carbon. We're going to change the way we drive cars maybe, but nothing about population.
Right. You know, the problem with that approach is, well, the main problem is there's a good chance it won't be sufficient to actually give us the carbon reductions we need to get a hold on the problem. Another problem with it, though, is when you keep pursuing efficiency improvements, what happens is you sort of grab the low-hanging fruit, you improve the efficiency, but of course, if you just keep adding more and more people, you're going to need more resources eventually. And then it's going to be much harder to get even more efficiency because you've sort of grabbed all the easiest things. There's a sense in which by not addressing population growth and economic growth, we may be boxing ourselves in and making it harder, not easier, to deal with the problem down the line.
But just look at the decades of abuse Paul and Ann Ehrlich took for their 1968 book, The Population Bomb. And then you've got the late American ecologist Garrett Hardin. He became the whipping boy when he discussed trying whatever it takes to limit human population. Is it any safer to talk about this now? Are you prepared for the verbal bricks coming your way?
Well, I am. You know, I in my own case, I've been an environmentalist for about 30 years, and for the first 20 of those or so, I really didn't talk about population, but I noticed that whatever else I was talking about, whether it was trying to keep water in rivers or keep new ski areas from destroying mountains, there was always a population component to it. Population growth was being used to justify the projects that I was trying to slow down. So eventually I waded into it, and what I found was you sort of get hated on in an equal opportunity way. People on the left don't really like it when you talk about immigration and reducing immigration. On the other hand, people on the right often don't like it when you talk about contraception or, heaven forbid, abortion rights. So maybe that's the only silver lining in this. You get it from both sides, and maybe that lets you keep standing.
Well, maybe that's why the big green groups, I mean, even brave ones like Greenpeace, don't want to talk about population control. They need to keep their supporters. They need to keep their funding. So how do we get around that one? I mean, this is the issue that almost broke up the Sierra Club in California.
Well, that's right, and it's hard. And I don't think every group has to deal with every issue. You know, people join a group like the Sierra Club for certain reasons, and if the club starts talking about completely different things, then they're going to be uncomfortable. But I do think there are some issues we just can't avoid, and I think population is one of them. Perhaps if these groups would, they don't even have to take a stand on the issue at this point, I think. If they could just start talking about it, if they could just start maybe having articles in their wonderful magazines about what some people think the role of population might be in, and just get people talking about it, I think that would be a great step forward.
Well, how much time do we have? Can we just start initiating a quiet, careful conversation, or do we have to really get going and do something about it?
I think we need to get going. And again, you know, it's kind of funny. We talk about climate change. We talk about these massive dead zones at the mouths of many of the world's great rivers. Scientists are talking very seriously about the disappearance of most of the world's coral reefs in 20 to 30 years. I take these as signs that humanity as a whole is really pushing up against some limits here. I think there's really no time to waste, and we need to get talking about these things.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Phil Cafaro. He's the president of the International Society for Environmental Ethics, and he's the president of the Board of Directors for Progressives for Immigration Reform. We're talking about a new book that challenges environmentalists and policymakers and the public to face up to the real climate damage caused by overpopulation. The book's many essayists argue we can't stop the worst climate change unless we stop population growth. So, Phil, on the plus side, what could we achieve as far as emissions go if we do manage to limit population growth?
Well, it turns out that there's an awful lot we can achieve through that. If you look at the United States, something like 5/6 of our emissions increases over the past 2.5 decades have come from population growth. So if we could get a handle on that, there are just very large savings that we could make. And of course, if you can manage to combine population stabilization with some of the good technological improvements that people are also working on, then you could see greenhouse gas emissions start to be pushed down. The problem is that in too many countries around the world, we've made good efficiency improvements in recent years, but we've used them to subsidize greater population growth. We need to get these things moving together.
Well, let's talk about how we do it. Slowing or reversing population growth is great so long as I don't have to do it. We want our kids and grandchildren just as we always have. Does voluntary population control work?
Well, I think it can work. I mean, the good news is an awful lot of what we want to do really is that kind of win-win solution that we talked about at the start of the program. In the developing world, where 95% of population growth is currently happening, there's very good evidence that when you give women and couples the opportunity to choose the number of children they have, they tend to choose to have fewer. So if we can manage to get contraception to the 250 million women around the world who want it but at this point in time don't have it, if we can get that to them inexpensively or for free, and if we can improve women's education, if we can improve the economic and social status of women around the world, those things have been proven to help drive down fertility rates. Now, when you look at countries like Canada and the United States, as I said earlier, there we've already made that demographic transition. We're already having fewer children voluntarily. And in Canada and the United States, the key to population stabilization is to reduce immigration. Now, a lot of people aren't going to like to hear that, but the reality is, in the past, we have had much lower immigration rates, and immigration rates are a function of the political choices we make. So we really, in this case, might have to choose between bringing in large numbers of people and benefiting them, perhaps in the short run, or stabilizing our populations.
Well, what about the case of India and China? Doesn't that show some state coercion may be necessary, like the one-child program? And the other thing about this new book of essays, Life on the Brink, I didn't see any authors from China or India in there. Why is that?
Well, Eileen Christ and I, the editor, we did reach out to various writers around the world. We would have liked to have gotten a little bit more of an international scope to the book. In the end, we went forward with the writers we had who made the commitments. But to get to your earlier question, what about coercion in China and India? There's no doubt that coercion has been there. In China, at least, it seems to have worked. There's something like 300 million fewer Chinese today than there would have been without the one-child policy. But interestingly enough, if you look at some of the nations right around China, they have driven fertility levels even lower than China has, and without using coercion. So in Thailand, in Vietnam, I think the numbers, fertility levels are way down. So that suggests to me that while coercion maybe has worked in some places in the past, you don't need coercion to drive fertility levels down. And that's good news, because we don't want to violate human rights in order to create a sustainable society. We want both of those things.
Well, getting back to the United States, I mean, Americans are finally willing to read about climate change. It was just in USA Today a couple of weekends ago. Even occasionally they might hear the president mention it. Are we ready to stir up this hornet's nest of anti-abortionist conspiracies about government control and the UN taking over? I could just hear this tsunami of ugly noise cranking up all over again. Is there any way to avoid all that nuttiness?
Well, there's no way to avoid the nuttiness completely. Because let's face it, when you open up a public debate, that means people get to have their say, and some of the public are going to be nuts. I think the best way to avoid the nuttiness is to do what we're doing right now, to try to have an intelligent discussion about these questions. That's why I was so disappointed back in the late 90s when the Sierra Club decided not to take a position on immigration in the United States. The rationale for that, in part, was, look, this debate's going to get ugly. We don't want to have anything to do with it. But actually, I think that's an abdication of our role as citizens. You know, the way to have a good debate is to have a good debate. It's not to just run away and expect a good debate to happen.
Could you tell us about just a couple of the arguments used by the longtime Greens in your new book, Life on the Brink?
Sure. Some people have a little bit more of an international focus, and some have a more North American focus. So that makes a difference to the kinds of arguments they make. But one very good argument comes from Tim Palmer, who's a longtime river advocate in California and along the west coast of the U.S. Tim talks about the work that he's done over the past 3.5 decades in California, the work he and other river advocates have done to convince people to leave more water in the rivers. They've had wonderful success at keeping some bad dam projects from being made, wonderful success in getting people to use both industry and agriculture and individuals to use water more efficiently. So in California today, people actually use about half as much water per capita as they did 4 decades ago. And Tim says, well, this is a wonderful achievement. The only problem is we've got twice as many people in California today. So there's just about as much pressure as there was 4 decades ago to take more water out of the rivers. And that means that's bad for fish, that's bad for ecosystems throughout California. So his point is just this: it's an exercise in futility, if you're an environmentalist, to push really hard for efficiency improvements and not deal with population issues.
Phil Cafaro, when I spoke with Paul Ehrlich recently, he said each additional human is far more than just one more. Why are the next 100 million humans more damaging than ever before?
Well, Paul says that for two main reasons. First, this next 100 million people are coming online, as it were, at a time when we're more technologically advanced than ever. And so they are going to be coming here, and their wants and the way they fulfill their needs, the way society meets their needs, is going to be much more resource intensive than 100 million people, let's say, 50 years ago. Another reason why those 100 million people are more important and more impactful is, in many ways, humanity has gone after the easiest, most accessible resources first. So now, in order to get those people, let's say, the oil and gas that they need, you might well have to be, for the oil, you might have to be drilling a couple miles under the ocean. And that means to get them their oil, you're taking a much greater environmental risk. So in all these ways, adding more people at this stage of the game is more impactful.
Well, that's why I was so discouraged to see China go for the car culture. I know they're doing a lot in renewable energy, and they're working on mass transit. They've got more rapid trains than the United States has. But, you know, it just seems like they didn't learn anything from the smog of L.A. in the early days, and now they've got it in Beijing. Maybe they saved 300 million people with the one-child policy, but they lost it all in emissions because they went for coal and cars. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that was a terrible way to go. It would have been much better to see them move in a direction of more mass transit and to keep bicycle culture for shorter trips. But, you know, that's not the way they moved. And I think part of it was a calculation about how much economic growth they could generate by getting people interested in having their own car. I mean, think about the role that plays in the economy, the automotive industry plays in the economies of Canada and the United States. And I think China's leaders looked at that and said, we want that. And China's people looked at cars and said, we want that. So that's the way it went.
Right. But all of our talk, even in this conversation, is about humans and what it means for humans. Do we really have the right to use all the photosynthesis, all the fresh water, every living space just for our growing needs?
I don't think we do, and that's a big part of the book. Well, I have a piece in there that I wrote with a graduate student arguing that other species have a right to continued existence on planet Earth. They have a right to be free from anthropogenic extinction. Now, I believe that very strongly, and we have good, strong laws, both in the United States and in Canada, to protect endangered species, which at some level make that same connection. What we haven't been able to do is say, there's a connection between preserving species and limiting the size of the human population and human economies. I think that's where we're at right now. That's what environmentalists have to grapple with. How do we make real this idea that other species have a right to continued existence? We have to acknowledge limits and figure out ways to justly live within limits.
Well, I think part of that is just to get people outside the cities into nature to actually experience that there is a world beyond the iPads and all of that. I know you've been looking into past mass extinction events. I'm wondering if we can see another one coming. Are we already in it? Would we even recognize it before we blow past any chance to stop it?
The biologists tell us that we have entered that period. There's a lot of debate about exactly, you know, what's happening at this moment. There's a lot of debate about if current trends continue, will we lose a quarter of the world's species in the next century or only half that number? But as I read the science, the biologists seem pretty convinced that we have entered the period of the sixth great mass extinction on Earth. And that's a sobering thought. The loss is just going to be tremendous. Species themselves are going to be lost. I think future human generations are going to find a much more crowded and much more depauperate world. I see my job in all this is trying to sound the alarm about that and maybe do my small part to try to limit that loss. But the loss is coming.
Well, bottom line here, Philip Cafaro, what should Greens be saying and doing about the population issue? What should we all be doing and saying?
Well, above all, we should be talking about it. I don't think we have to all come to exactly the same personal or policy conclusions about that. But on the personal level, I mean, for me, after I had my two children, I had a vasectomy. That seemed to me to be a very important thing to do as a good environmentalist. On a policy level, I think we should be, in the United States at the moment, we're talking about comprehensive immigration reform. Whatever the final bill that Congress passes looks like, I think we should discuss what the implications are of that bill for future U.S. population growth. And at the international level, I think whatever the wealthy nations of the world can do to help provide resources for contraception in poorer countries, that can just do a world of good. So there's a lot we can do, but I think it all starts with realizing that every person makes certain demands on the planet, and we have to take that into account if we want to be good environmentalists.
So what is next for you? What are you working on?
Well, currently I'm finishing up a book looking at immigration policy and ethics in the United States, and then I'd like to step back a little and maybe develop further these arguments that people really should respect other species and acknowledge their right to continued existence. I'm interested in making those arguments as strong as possible.
We've been talking about the almost unspeakable, the huge impacts of human population growth on climate change and the species. Our guest is Philip Cafaro. He's the co-editor of a new book, Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. It's a collection of fine essays, in my opinion, from some of the biggest progressive names in American environmentalism. The other editor is Eileen Crist from Virginia Tech, known for her book, Gaia in Turmoil. The book is published by University of Georgia Press. Find links to Philip and the book in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Phil, thank you for standing up when others duck the tough issues.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall never surrender.
As always, please support your local nonprofit radio station. One of the best since 1960, WBAI New York is in emergency fundraising mode to keep their famous transmitter atop the Empire State Building. That station has not yet recovered from being flooded out by Hurricane Sandy. In fact, every nonprofit and community radio station needs your help right now more than ever. Don't take anything for granted. If you love freedom of the airwaves without corporate control, please get online or on the phone and put your money where your ears are to support your local radio station. A huge thank you to Radio EcoShock supporters who keep this program on the air. Rebecca in Australia, your generous donation gave me renewed determination to keep pumping out the awful truth. I can't thank everyone personally, but listeners around the world make this show possible. I am grateful for donations coming in through our website and blog. Help yourself while you're there to our big library of free MP3 audio downloads at ecoshock.org. Coming up on Radio EcoShock, the new wave of low-energy homes and new waves of rising seas. Is it still safe to live near the coast? Plus, a surprise guest who always puts Earth first. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. I'm going to squeeze in part of another song from Nimbin, Australia. The group is Pagan Love Cult. It's their CSG song, meaning coal seam gas, also known as fracking methane.
From where I stand, I see this land as a paradise that's there for all to share. Green tree growing, water flowing, blue sky overhead, clean fresh air. But there's a corporate man with a short-term plan, licensed by the government to drill. He'll take what he wants and he'll trash the rest, leave behind a poison mess when his hat is filled. Got the weight of the state on a golden plate. The cops, the courts, the rule of the law is on his side. Poison the air, set fire to the water. This is madness, this is slaughter, this is suicide. Drink from the river or die of thirst. There's a crack in the sky, the dam's about to burst.